didn't, and I can't claim to have thought better of it. I just felt strange all over. Everything was going very fast, including the quitting time rhythm, which I certainly had thought would slow and then stop when I got to town. Instead, everything I wanted to do all summer, I wanted to do right now. I wanted to find the Chinese restaurant, which all the bitterrooters in the woods said was the best eating place in town. And I wanted to find this Oxford gambling joint and watch their shills at work. And I more or less wanted to find a hotel and leave my pack and wash up and maybe lie down before going out on the town. This idea of lying down for a while interested me least of all. So I stopped somebody outside and asked where the Chinaman's was, and I think it was in the same block, on Main between 3rd and 2nd. The Chinaman behind the cash register wore a silky black coat, a white shirt, and a black string tie. And he studied me in my patches and pack and my hair that hadn't been cut in 3 months. He clearly didn't care for any Forest Service trade from Elk Summit. But without being asked, I walked back near the kitchen and sat down at the smallest table in the room. I put my pack on the other chair for a guest. A white waitress came with a menu. Her voice was husky, and she was the first woman I had smelled all summer. And she smelled like a woman. I couldn't read what was on the menu. Maybe I didn't know the names of Chinese food, or maybe I just couldn't see very well. The waitress came back several times and looked at me. I finally thought, probably I'm dirty, so I asked her where the men's room was, and I washed in cold water and wiped myself with a cloth towel that came out about a foot at a time when I pushed a button. I wet my hair, but my comb was in my pack, so my hair was wet and stringy when I came back. And despite the cold water, I didn't feel any better. She returned soon and still looked troubled and finally asked, "Do you think you should order now? Why not wait another hour or so before you eat?" I would never have got to Hamilton if I felt that way about things. I said, "No, I want to order now." She must have known that she would have to order for me. She would ask, "Wouldn't you like to try?" And then she would name something that ended with Sui or Maine. Each time I would say, "That would be just fine." I was over-polite in trying to show her that, despite the way I looked, I was really at home in such classy establishments as Chinese restaurants. I kept saying, "Yes, that would be just fine," until she stuck the pencil in her blouse and headed for the kitchen. The moment I was alone, I got very sick. I do not know whether I knew I was very sick. What I knew was that the world was made of two parts, inside and outside a Chinese restaurant, and that I was sure to feel better if only I could get to wherever I was not now. Later, I could look for the Oxford. When the waitress finally came, I said, "Would you please give me my check?" She was frightened and said, "But you haven't even eaten yet." I said, "I know, just bring me the check." She said, "Would you please wait a moment?" And she went not to the kitchen, but to the cash register and talked to the Chinaman with a string tie. Everything inside me was going sickeningly fast, and everything outside was standing sickeningly still. I wondered how much longer I could wait for my check and then fresh air. I could even guess what they were whispering behind the cash register. Lumberjacks had pretty much the same joke that they played on Chinamen behind cash registers. Four or five Jacks would finish eating together, and then one would saunter to the front and say to the Chinaman, "He," pointing in the general direction of the table, "is going to pay for mine. He," pointing in the same general direction, "lost a bet to me." Then he would slide by. And this would go on until only one Jack was left who would put down just enough money for his own dinner. "Hell, what do you mean, me paying for those other guys? I don't even hardly know them." I was alone, but clearly I was from the Forest Service, and I had ordered dinner, and now I was trying to get out of the restaurant before it was even served. It was a somewhat different lumberjack game, but it had to be a game between a lumberjack and a Chinaman that a Chinaman was supposed to lose. The waitress hurried past me to the kitchen, obviously not looking my way. I couldn't wait any longer for anybody to talk to anybody else. I got up and thought I did pretty well to remember my pack. The kitchen door opened, and I never knew before how many Chinamen work in the kitchen of a Chinese restaurant. Families of them, from children to old men, each outfitted with a butcher knife. They followed slowly behind me to the cash register. The waitress stood frightened by herself. She thought, "Now I've done it." I looked at the bill several times to be sure that it was not more than the silver dollar in my hand. And then I put both on the counter next to the cash register. And I remember thinking that my paying the bill was a kind of inscrutable joke on the Chinese. I reached out my hand for the change and knocked over the glass of toothpicks, and then slid slowly to the floor in a cloud of toothpicks. I do not remember hitting the floor. The next thing I remember was a husky voice and the smell of a woman. And when I opened my eyes, I felt, more than saw, that the waitress was washing my face with a napkin, and I immediately fell in love with her. Wherever I had been very lonely, and I immediately fell in love with her for bending over me. The Chinamen leaned forward in a circle and were scared by what they saw. The Chinaman with a string tie was unhappy because it was happening in his place. The waitress made a big thing of smiling and said, "We've called the doctor." I thought that would be quite a while, but when I opened my eyes next, he had already listened to my chest and was lifting me up to listen to me through my back. When he saw I was awake, he asked questions. He was an old man. He wore a Stetson. And we all knew immediately that he was good. No one said a word unless the doctor asked him. And the doctor knew we were all scared and wanted to tell us not to be as soon as he could. He pulled my shirt together and before he started to button it, he said, "It was those goddamn ice cream sodas." He talked to all of us, not just to me. He said it was this way. I had walked too far, it was very hot, and I didn't drink anything. Then I drank two goddamn ice cream sodas. This is the way he explained to us what happened medically. He said my blood from the exertion, he said exertion, was mostly in the outside of me. In my legs and arms and muscles. Then I drank the two goddamn ice cream sodas, and they were cold, and so the blood all rushed to the inside of me and left my head empty, and I fainted. He said, "Don't worry. Take it easy for a day or so, and you'll feel as good as ever." All of us thought we understood everything and were greatly relieved. He was a small-town doctor, and I have never asked a big-town doctor for his opinion of the small-town doctor's medical explanation. I am sure, though, that no big-town doctor ever said what the small-town doctor said to me next. He said, "You come to see me late tomorrow morning in my office, you hear? If you don't come tomorrow, I'll charge you for tonight. If you come tomorrow, I won't charge you for tomorrow or tonight. All I want is to know that you are well." Then the circle began to break up, and people helped me to find the change that had slipped out of my hand when I'd fallen. The doctor said to the Chinaman with the silk coat, "Get him to a hotel." I don't remember anything for a long time after that. Either I fainted again or I just went to sleep. Even while I was waking, I knew I should be in a hotel. I got up and checked my clothes, and they were on a chair. And my pack was in a corner, and about the amount of money I should have had was in a pocket. I knew I'd been asleep for a while, but I also knew it was a long time until daybreak. I went back to bed to check on myself and the surroundings. At first, I tried to find out about myself, but before long, the surroundings forced themselves upon my attention. Not, however, until I realized this must be early morning of Saturday night in Hamilton. It was still too early in the morning to know how I would feel about the night when it got here, but I felt very bad about the night before, when I fell in front of the cash register with toothpicks in my hair. As far as I knew, no one ever before had fainted except women, and then only in books. I had actually never known a person who had fainted. Suddenly I felt one of those great waves of sadness that rarely come over me. I had made it clear from Elk Summit, only to lie down on the floor of a Chinese restaurant. Now nothing was left that could be mentioned to Bill about a day 14 miles up and 14 miles down with 5 or 6 miles still left to go. The coming night would be the last night when the ranger and the cook and the crew and I would be together. I got hold of myself and said, I'd better be good tonight, and that damn cook had better faint. I explored myself a little further. I wish I felt a little better. I'm not feeling bad, but I'd be afraid to get up and walk down the hall and find out. About here, the surroundings took over. A big ass pushed the wall next to my bed and gave me a nudge. As the books would say, I sat bolt upright. It had to be an ass, but how the hell did it come through the wall? It was half light in my room, and I studied the wall. So help me, it was made of canvas. Likewise the other wall, but once in a while the wall beside my bed bulged as if the glacier that had made Blodgett Canyon was at work next door. Suddenly I remembered things that aged Mr. Smith and Mr. McBride had told me. This is just like an old-time Western whorehouse, I thought, with canvas partitions between the cribs. I watched and listened, and after I saw and heard what was happening in the next room and was extending into part of mine, I said, what the hell do I mean, like an old-time Western whorehouse? This is the thing itself. At first I thought that there had to be several people in the crib next door, but I finally added up everything and settled for a pimp and a whore screwing up and down the bed, occasionally swerving out of their course and then returning to leave peaks and pinnacles on my wall. It was only his ass that took the scenic route, unfortunately. Hers must have kept on a straight course and never nudged me, and I eventually came to understand why. She talked all the time in a monotone, and while they screwed, she talked about how he had been out screwing other whores. I happened to be very sensitive to rhythm that year, and I finally realized that I could scan what she was saying. If I allowed for understandable caesuras, she was speaking blank verse. That year, I had taken an English course from the most famous teacher in our high school. She was very good, but perhaps was a little overwrought about poetry and students. Anyway, by early winter, she decided her juniors could write a sonnet, so she assigned one. At that time, high school juniors in Montana could tell where a cinch ended and a latigo began, but had no such knowledge about an octave and a sestet. So after feeling steadily worse for several days, I approached my mother with my problem, who looked at me carefully to be sure I had a problem, and then said, "After dishes, I will help you." So we sat down at a table, and I held her left hand, and she wrote the sonnet with her right hand while her left hand trembled. Her sonnet was On Milton's Blindness, something I'd never heard of before. The poem was regarded as very good by the English teachers of Missoula County High School, and in May received the prize as the best poem of the year, and was published in the school annual with a sterilized photograph of me adjoining it. My mother was very proud of me, but quietly insisted that I stay in after supper until I at least learned to scan. So again we sat at the table, this time with Milton or Shakespeare between us, and again I held her left hand, and with her right hand she would beat out the accented syllables. Then we would write lines of our own iambic pentameter. In our blank verse, unlike Milton's or Shakespeare's, never had any little odds or ends left over. We wrote, Immortal Milton, builder of my soul, and other such lines that all Montana high school juniors could scan and tell was poetry, at least if they could count to five. At first, I hadn't picked up the rhythm next door. Evidently she was just warming up, and she spoke in just ordinary, irritable profanity. You lousy bastard, and so on. But then she started to dedicate a stave to each time he had double-crossed her, and each stave she ended with, You are as crooked as a tub of guts. She liked this line and used it as a kind of refrain, and From it, I picked up the scansion and realized for the first time that she was speaking iambic pentameter, but with skips and jumps here and there. More like Milton and Shakespeare than Mother or me. Evidently, her man not only had done her wrong, but had gone around talking about it, because she had another set of staves she always ended with, "You're like a baby crow, all mouth and ass." I couldn't verify what she said about his mouth, because he was too busy ever to open it. But all you had to do to check his big ass was to watch my wall. It went down my wall like a wave and back up it like a rainbow trout. I was about to consider her imagery when I must have fallen asleep, possibly lulled by her rhythms, and when I woke up, certainly much later, there was not a stir next door. I was nervous for having fallen asleep and wondered whether this business about a pimp and a whore and especially iambic pentameter wasn't a dream, a distorted continuation of my rhythm in my sickness. Outside in the hall, a kind of marching was going on that faded and returned. I waited until it was in a fading cycle before sticking out my head, and sure enough, it had to be him, though all that could be seen clearly was a hairy ass that could be recognized even by gaslight. When he turned at the end of the hall, there she was in his arms, with her little ass and knees draped in a V. Evidently they were out for a stroll, taking a breather before the real work of the night began. They came up the hall toward me, and somehow I couldn't pull my neck in. They went right by my immovable nose and then made for their room. He was a man with his toes turned up and too much in love with his work to notice me. But she was just as nasty-looking a little whore as you will ever see. And whatever she and this big ape were doing, clearly she could think of two or three other things at the same time, including me. She half-twisted her neck off her shoulders just to give me the once-over. Then, adding a twist to the twist, she said, "Go fuck yourself." So she still scanned, although no one will give her grade points in originality for declaiming one of the most famous lines in the English language. The old lumberjacks used to talk about a walking whorehouse, and now what they meant became clearer. I was about to say next, all night whores flitted around the hotel. But I remembered in time that whores don't flit. One whore almost came through the other side of my wall. She came so close to coming through that somebody must have tried to throw her through. You know, I wasn't very well while all this was happening, and eventually I fell asleep, not to awaken until late in the morning when, I thought, I was much refreshed. Anyway, I was all full of rhythms. To my quitting time rhythm were permanently added those of my next-door neighbor. These were all iambic. But the one that now was pounding loudest was Saturday Night in Hamilton. I didn't know the name of this rhythm, but it sounded something like, "This is the forest primeval." After dressing a little more shakily than expected, I took a tryout down the hall and lay down again. Finally, I went out for breakfast and looked for some place that wasn't the Chinese restaurant, for fear the waitress I fell in love with last night might not look any better in the daylight than I felt. I found a Greek restaurant, and never again went back to the Chinese restaurant in order to preserve my first feelings about the waitress there. With a menu in front of me, I thought for a long time and finally ordered tea and toast. The expression on this new waitress's face suggested that she hadn't fallen in love with me on first sight, and that this workman's restaurant didn't welcome short orders, especially when they included tea instead of coffee. To make matters worse, I managed to put away the tea, but not the toast. Then I went looking for the doctor's office, and found it in a building a block off Main Street, where the rents were lower. The office was small and crowded, and the air around which it had been built must have been the air which was still there. People sat on the exposed springs of couches, and the name of the doctor was Charles Ritchie, M.D., spelled backward on the window. Dr. Ritchie did not practice a complicated branch of medicine. He wore his black Stetson in the office and spent about 5 minutes with each patient. He would stick his Stetson out of the inner office, point his finger at a patient, and wiggle his finger. When it came my turn, he had his earphones on before I got through his door. He never said a word, and he worried me when he went back to listen to the same spot on my chest. Finally, he jerked the phones out of his ears, and like the night before, he tried to say something cheerful as soon as he was sure. He said, "You're all right." Then he asked me where I lived, and I told him Missoula, and he told me I'd better stay in Hamilton for another night. "Take it easy a little longer," he said, "and don't get in any fights." I was an especially uncomplicated case, and he had only one more thing to say to me. He said, "It was those goddamn ice cream sodas. After this, never drink anything but good whiskey." It seemed like good advice, and besides, it came free. So by way of expressing my gratitude, I have followed it ever since. I tried to thank him, but he was already wiggling his finger at another patient. On the way back to my room, I kept an eye open for a different hotel and saw one that said it was deluxe at 25 cents per night, double that with bath. Just as I was to enter my old room to pack up, I noted that my neighbor's room was wide open, and she was standing naked in front of a mirror trying on a hat. She was adding to her stature by wearing high-heeled shoes and tilting a very large hat this way and that, but when she saw me, she took off her hat so as not to impede her vision. What she said to me she had said once before, and so of course it still scanned. After I got into my own room, I had to lie down again. I lay there hoping that someday my next-door neighbor and the cook would meet socially. Concerning the outcome, I didn't care which one lost. Later, I collected myself and my stuff, went downstairs, and couldn't find anybody to pay. In that hotel, they probably didn't charge by the room. I don't remember whether it was from the exertion of moving, but when I got to my new room, I had to stretch out again. I rolled over, and for the first time since I'd left home in the spring, I felt the security of rubbing shoulders with a plaster wall. And for the first time in several days, I almost overslept. As I woke, I knew I'd no time to enjoy in waking. I knew even before looking at my watch that Bill and the crew should be arriving, or already had arrived from what should have been the camp on Big Sand Lake near the Divide. I washed my face from a pitcher, but the water was stale, just like the knowledge that I would have nothing to say about walking from Elk Summit in a day. By the time I got to the corral on the road to Blodgett Canyon that the Forest Service used to hold the stock, Bill was already unloading the string, and the cook and the Canadian were sitting in the shade of a deserted cabin that the service had turned into a warehouse. Since the rest of the crew hadn't arrived, it was clear that the cook and the Canadian had ridden in, and that the rest of the crew, including Mr. Smith with tiny, aged steps, were somewhere behind on foot. No one could kick about the Canadian riding and then just sitting there and not helping Bill unload. He was lucky to be alive after a horse had brought him down that canyon. As for the cook, you might feel like kicking him onto his feet, but you'd restrain yourself if you knew anything about the woods. In the woods, the cooks are known as the kings of the camps, and they sit on the throne because in the woods, eating is what counts most in life. In the woods, you work so damn hard you have to spend most of the rest of the time taking on fuel. And besides, if you're looking for your just rewards in the Forest Service, which has never been noted for wages, you'd better eat all you can while you're there and enjoy it if possible. So in the woods, the rest of us do everything that has to be done, but the damn cook only cooks and talks to the boss. Without saying a word, Bill and I unloaded and unsaddled the string and carried the packs, saddles, and drenched saddle blankets into the warehouse, right past the cook, who sat in the shade, swatting flies. Finally, Bill and I had a conversation. In the Forest Service, very few sentences are completed, either because you have to grunt or catch your breath, or because guys who work in the woods aren't the kind who go running around finishing sentences. Bill was taking off the pack on one side of a mule, and I was taking off the other. He asked, "How did you..." And as the pack slipped on my shoulders, I grunted, "I made..." Which, if we had the air and inclination to finish, would probably have sounded something like this. Question: how did you make it, walking from Elk Summit? Answer: I made it, but don't ask anything more. We must have understood each other without finishing, because nothing further was said until the crew came straggling into the corral. They crawled through the corral bars and sat down in the shade near the cook and Canadian. Then all of them together said nothing. I especially cared for Mr. Smith, who cared for me, and it was painful to see how short his steps were, and how white with perspiration his neck was above his bandana handkerchief, where it was usually dark with old veins. While the crew rested, Bill and I fed the stock oats. It was September, and you can't pack animals all summer over the Bitterroot Divide and expect them to survive on the grass they pass on the way. Bill didn't say he was proud of them, but he slapped each one on its rump as it snorted into its feed. At the end of the summer, they looked fine. After he finished with the animals, he turned to the men. He and Mr. Smith did all the talking, although I don't think they'd worked things out beforehand. Bill said, "We're one crew, but don't let's hang together in one bunch until we get to the Oxford. It would look bad." Mr. Smith asked, "When do you want us, Bill?" Bill said, "Drift into this Oxford place between 9:30 and 10. Mr. Smith was showing remarkable recuperative powers for his age. He took off the bandana handkerchief and wiped his neck. He seemed to be talking always to Bill and not to us. "Bill," he said, "you take charge of the inside of that poker room, and I'll stand at the door and take care of whatever tries to get in from the pool room." Bill said to me, "You're to get the money if anything goes wrong." And then he added, as he always did, "I'll cover you." Mr. McBride had something to say to Bill, and he had a point. "Be sure we play for money and not for chips. We may not be able to cash in any chips on the way out." Bill said, "The rest of you, help where we're hurting. You're a good crew, and we don't want too many plans." Mr. Smith agreed, "That's right. For what we're doing, we don't want too many plans." Then the cook spoke up and added one of his stately speeches. "You must realize," he said, "that I rarely make a tricky deal. If I won only when I dealt, I would have been dead long ago. Except for one or two hands a night, I am a percentage player," which was the first time I had ever heard this phrase. "I am a very good percentage player, and I should be ahead. But if I am not, don't lose patience. There will come one big hand, and be ready." So the cook had the last word, as I'm sure he planned. He liked being the center of the drama, and he liked being Bill's favorite. Mr. Smith and I exchanged our dislike of him by a glance. Then we soon broke up, as directed. And on the way back to my room, I stopped at my new restaurant, where I was not well liked, and asked the waitress if they had a small flour sack they could spare. She seemed to like me better, and came back from the kitchen and said no, they didn't have a flour sack, but they had a 10-pound sugar sack. And she showed it to me, and the word sugar had not yet faded from being washed. I said, "That's fine. That's better than flour. In fact, sugar seemed just right, since I wanted the sack to put our big winnings in." It's funny how many non-funny jokes we make to ourselves. I'd been gone from my room for a long time, so when I got back, I lay down on the bed and was still amused by my sugar sack when all of a sudden things fell apart. I say all of a sudden, but for a long time I had only been pretending not to know that I was going to take a hell of a beating when I reached across the table to pick up the money. I always suspected that Bill was looking for trouble more than for money. But from time to time I would cheer myself up by underestimating the crew and thinking they were just greedy, not fighty, and would take their winnings and go off and get drunk. I had not fully realized how I was doomed until I had seen that the oldest men in the crew, Mr. Smith and Mr. McBride, were counting on a fight just as much as Bill was, and independently had worked out an almost identical plan. In fact, when I said a temporary goodbye to Mr. Smith at the corral, I discovered that the crew's fighting plans didn't stop with the Tinhorn Gamblers. He said, "We're going to clean out the town. First we'll take those Tinhorn Gamblers, then the ranch hands, and then the whores." If we did all that, we sure as hell would clean out the town as we knew it. As we knew the town, there were houses in it, but we weren't sure what, if anything, was inside them. The establishments open to us were inhabited by gamblers, ranch hands, and whores. Add a Chinese and a Greek restaurant, and you have what the town was to us. You will note that Mr. Smith and I both said ranch hands and not cowboys. In the Forest Service, we called cowboys ranch hands to show what we thought of them. I said to Mr. Smith, "The whores may be the toughest of all." He laughed through his mustache that was darker than his white hair. He was hoping this would be the case. There shouldn't have been any doubt in my mind, though, that we were in for big trouble. After all, I was finishing up my third summer in the Forest Service. So twice before, I had gone through this autumn rite at quitting time. Twice before, I had seen a catch-as-catch-can bunch of working stiffs transformed into blood brothers by the act of cleaning out the town. Everybody got cleaned in this autumn rite of the early Forest Service. We cleaned up on the town, and the town cleaned us out. When the rite was completed, all of it thereafter could be solemnized and capitalized. The crew, quitting time, and cleaning out the town. Everything about us was bigger than before, except our cash. At the time, I thought the big fire was no longer important. But before all this became a story, I realized the big fire is the summer festival, and cleaning out the town is the way it all ends in the autumn. It's as simple as this. You never forget the guys who helped you fight the big fire or clean out the town. Lying on the bed, though, I couldn't see how I was going to avoid a beating. There's bound to be a fight, I knew now, and I'll have to reach over the table for the money. I'll need both hands to pick it up and put it in the sugar sack, which didn't seem funny now, and there will be my jaw sticking out for anybody to bruise with brass knuckles. I lay on the bed for some hours and couldn't think of a way to protect myself. And worse still, I knew I'd thought often of this problem before and had kept burying it, because even in half dreams no way came to me of defending myself. Now was my last chance to think, but after it became dark I still had no thoughts, just sensations. Always I felt that in reaching for the money, I was hit on the jaw from the side and couldn't see who had hit me. Next, I felt blood from inside my head slide down my throat. I don't pretend I liked the beating or the blood, but it was not being able to lift a hand that sickened me most. It was like being a child again and being sent to a dark room and waiting for your father to come and whip you. It was a place of no ideas. Finally, I said to myself, "At least don't lie here in the dark. Go over and take a look at the joint." I don't know whether I expected to get any new ideas, but at least I went to see. The Oxford was the combination billiard, pool, and card parlor, which for many Westerners was the home away from home. The entering door led past the bar and tobacco stand. The guy behind the bar looked like he was trying to look like the owner. I bought a bottle of homebrew beer, but if I'd asked for a shot of moonshine, I probably could have got it. Then I sauntered through the big door into the game room. It retreated to the rear in geometric patterns. The farther back it went, the higher the stakes, the deeper the sin, and the lower the social order. The large rectangles of billiard and pool tables in front become shortened by distance into round card tables. The ceilings were concealed in darkness. Each green cloth-covered table glared under its own light shade. The big room narrowed into one small, slightly raised room, in which was one glaring green table surrounded almost by darkness. Here at the end of space was the poker table. I worked slowly to the rear, pretending to walk casually and trying to drink the flat beer. The billiard table was for the sporting elite, who could pay 25 cents an hour. The table was in good shape, and the two players were good, and were playing three-cushion billiards. The spectator next to me clapped when they made a hard shot, and in a whisper told me that one of the players was the best barber in town, and the other was vice president of the bank. Then, in an even lower whisper, and in greater awe, he told me that by common agreement they quit playing every night at 9 because each had a woman he spent a couple of hours with before going home to his wife. The pool players and tables were so bad nobody was watching. The balls must have been made of concrete, and the rubber in the cushions was dead. So the players, to get any bounce, shot too hard. If you fired a rifle and jerked up your head and shoulder the way they did when they shot their cue ball, you'd have missed Grave Peak at 100 yards. When they miscued, they said, "God damn it," and chalked the tips of their cues. You can tell poor pool players anywhere. They're the ones who are always saying, "God damn it," and are always chalking their cues and always jerking their heads when they shoot. Something chalk won't cure. On the rifle range, it's called flinching. I kept moving and came to the first card tables. The Oxford was no exception. The first card tables are always for the regular local players. Not the gamblers, but the clothing store clerks and delivery men who married when they were young and can't afford to lose but can't stay away from cards. So they pretend, with the help of the house, that they're not gambling, and certainly not losing. They play slow games in which they lose steadily, but never, as in poker, lose a bundle of cash on a turn of a card. The ones I watched were playing pan and pinochle, and they were playing for chits, not chips. They had paid real money for their chits, as if they were chips. But when they traded them back, the house would give them only trade tokens that would allow them to buy homebrew beer or play pool. The house was even pretending that it wasn't charging them for using the table. But while I stood there, a houseman came by and picked a chit out of the pot. If you count the number of times the houseman picks a chit out of a pot in a year, you'll probably find that it's not the gamblers but the delivering men pretending they aren't gambling who keep small-town gambling joints going financially. I pretended to be drinking from my bottle of beer when I passed the poker room so that they couldn't get a good look at me. There were 3 of them, also engaged in pretending. They were pretending to play poker against each other, and they were studying their cards and stroking their piles of chips with their left hands. It was a cinch. They were all housemen, and were just keeping a game going as a decoy for some working stiff with a paycheck from the Forest Service or a sheep ranch. They were all dressed alike, and were all dressed like Bill Bell. Black Stetson hats, blue shirts, and yellow strings from sacks of Bull Durham hanging out of their shirt pockets. I wondered if all the guys in the Bitterroot who thought they were tough wore some kind of uniform, because even the doctor wore a small black Stetson. They pretended that no one was standing in the doorway as, faceless, they studied their cards under their hat brims. Then, almost as one, the hat brims raised slightly and they peered from underneath. What made it a cinch they were all shills working for the house was that nobody watched them play. Any Westerner knows that when nobody watches the poker game isn't real. The poker game is magnetic north, and when even a sheep herder with his summer's pay is drawn into the magnetic field, a circle forms around it. Not wanting them to get a good look at me, I kept moving. Then I didn't get a good look at them either. Mostly what I saw down the sides of my tipped beer bottle were the brims of their hats and their hunched shoulders shielding their cards. Their black hats were black, but not like Bill's black hat, gray with dust. Hunched shoulders always looked big, but one pair looked at least as big as Bill's. I began to think of him as biggest brim, and the other two as big brim and bigger brim, just like olives, the smallest grade always being marked large. Not much else of them was allowed to show except their hands, which looked as if they were trying to be clumsy to get me into the game. Something had made me crawl out of bed and go spying, although I hadn't learned much. My first view of the tinhorn gamblers in the flesh wasn't a great deal different from my mental image of tinhorn gamblers. They were faceless, but had an eye on me. I had learned just one thing for sure. It was a long way from the poker room in the rear to the front door. And I made a note, if we had to back out fighting, to watch sideways for anybody who might be swinging the butt of a pool cue. I was nervous and much too early, and although still not feeling well, I began to realize I hadn't eaten much of anything since leaving Elk Summit. I crossed the street to the Greek restaurant with a waitress who didn't like me. The waitress was on shift, gave my table a swish with her apron, and said, as if there had always been complete understanding between us, "You're going to eat something tonight. You haven't eaten anything since you came to town." I said, "I was thinking the same thing myself." "I'll get some soup while you look in the menu over," she said. "Be sure to order meat. It'll make you strong again." I thought about her all the time she was in the kitchen. I wasn't exactly prepared for this sudden motherly change in events. And when you're hurt, you don't forgive quickly. Looking at the soup as she put it down, she said, "I think I know where Bill Bell's dog is." The soup came up in steam, and I was glad it smelled good because that meant I was better. So for a moment, I really didn't hear what she said. When I did, I asked, "You know Bill Bell?" Then she didn't hear. "You must order something with a lot of meat." She helped me think things over, and after a lot of thought, we decided on what anyone probably would have. A hamburger, rare and with onions. On a theory we both shared, that rare and onions make you strong. When she came back from the kitchen after ordering, she said, "I don't know Bill Bell, but I know where his dog is. Did you like your soup?" "It was good and hot," I said, and left it up to her to go on. As she lifted the soup bowl and brushed off the bits of crackers from the table, she said, "I come from a sheep ranch near Darby, and I've heard his dog is on a sheep ranch near Hamilton. I can tell you where." This time she was gone quite a while, waiting for the hamburger to get done. I knew that she was probably right about Bill's dog. Like Bill himself, the dog was one of the legends of the Bitterroot Valley. He had a name, but everybody called him Bill's dog. He liked Bill best among humans, but he had an even higher commitment. He was committed to sheep. He would follow Bill into the woods in the spring, and he liked especially to be around Bill when he was working with livestock or twirling his rope in the evening. But by the middle of July, he would get an inner call and be gone. And when autumn came, Bill would find him at some sheep camp. As a sheepdog, he specialized on coyotes. Coyotes are wily animals, but wily animals, including ourselves and coyotes, have more set patterns than we think. The sheep camp is usually on a creek bottom or near a spring. And one coyote usually appears on top of a nearby ridge and barks like hell and makes a big show of himself. And the sheepdog, following his usual pattern, takes out after the coyote, and the coyote, of course, disappears over the hill. Then it so happens that when the dog comes sailing over the ridge with his tongue hanging out, there are three or four coyotes waiting to meet him. The first coyote didn't know that just what Bill's dog was looking for was three or four coyotes. Bill's dog looked as if he were divided into two parts, his head and shoulders being pit bull, and the remaining half with which he ran being greyhound. Probably nothing in the valley touched him for speed and ferocity. Actually, he wasn't so much committed to sheep as he was to sheep camps where he could kill coyotes. Every sheep camp in the valley regarded it a privilege to entertain him. The waitress came back and asked, "When is Bill going to leave tomorrow for Elk Summit?" "It's a guess," I told her, "but I'd guess around noon." "I'll try to get his dog to him in the morning," she said. "But if I don't make it, here's a piece of paper that tells the ranch where he is and how to get there. Will you give the note to Bill?" I nodded and put it in my shirt pocket. "So you don't know Bill?" I asked. I cut the hamburger sandwich into four pieces, and even then it was big, and I had to open my mouth wide. She said, "No, I come from Darby, and I ran away to go to Missoula." Missoula was my town. It is the biggest town around and is near the mouth of the Bitterroot River. Darby is a small town about 70 miles up the Bitterroot River, and Hamilton is in between in both distance and size, but closer to Darby than to Missoula. "But," she said, "I got a job here in Hamilton slinging hash, and somehow I never got as far as Missoula." Since I was still trying to open my mouth wide, she went on, "I'm a Bitterrooter, so even if I don't know Bill Bell, I know all about him and his dog." She had dark red hair, and perhaps her teeth were a little too far apart, but she looked good. and she looked strong, and it was not hard to imagine her on a sheep ranch. Her face and neck were covered with outdoor freckles, and they got even thicker as they disappeared toward her breasts. "I know you work for Bill," she said. And then she said, as if she'd tried to say it before, "And I know you're in for big trouble tonight." I put down the remaining quarter of the sandwich. "How do you know that?" I asked. "Men eat here," she said. I looked at the clock and told her, "I have to be going." She said, "You haven't finished your sandwich." I assured her, "It was good, but I have to be on my way." "All right," she said. "But don't forget about Bill's dog." "I won't," I told her. "Be sure now," she said, "not to forget about Bill's dog. I want you to think about him tonight." "You sound smart," I told her. "No," she said. "I haven't been to Missoula yet." The Bitterroot girl who followed me to the door was about my age, and we both felt it. "So long and good luck," she said. Then she called after me. "Don't forget to tell Bill that I gave him the slip of paper, but you're not supposed to look at it." "I'll tell him," I called back. And then I put all my life out of my mind except around a poker table. I focused so intensely, I still remember all that happened as if it were last night. There was no one in the bar room except the guy behind the bar, who looked as if he were about to lose the place he may have owned. For a moment, I thought there was no sound at all in the next room. Then suddenly a crash was followed by several thuds, as the life went out of concrete pool balls when they hit dead cushions. Evidently one pair of pool players was left. "Hey, punk," the barkeep snarled. "Where do you think you're going?" I was late and worried because there was just one set of sounds in the next room, so I tried to slide past by being polite. "I'm supposed to meet with some friends in there," I said. "Come over here," he said. Then I got really worried, because I should have been standing right behind the cook. But I went partway to the bar, close enough to see a Smith & Wesson 38 on the lower counter where he washed the glasses. No revolver had been there when I bought my homemade beer. He stopped looking at me long enough to take a drink from the shot glass sitting by the revolver. "Have a shot of moonshine," he said to me. "Thanks," I said, and shook my head. "It's on the house," he said. And I said, "Thanks," again. He said, actually pointing at me, "You're with Bill Bell, aren't you? You were in here not long ago." I said, "I work for him." "He's in there," he told me. "What's he doing in there?" I asked. "Why don't you look in there and tell me?" he asked. I could see that I would be here forever if I kept on being polite. I said, "Why don't you look in there yourself? You've got a gun, and it's only 20 feet to the door where you can look." He said, "I'm afraid to leave the front of the place alone. Somebody might come in and steal something." I took another look, and when I saw it actually wasn't 20 feet to the door, I realized he was scared. I don't like guys who look big and tough but aren't, and also happen to have a gun. When they're tough all the way through, it's easier to figure out what the gun will do. I walked those less than 20 feet softly and looked. Just as Sound had said, in all the big room there were only 2 pool players. Probably a couple of ranch hands who had worked with cattle so long they didn't notice any more what went on among humans. Otherwise, it was as if the earth had tilted and everybody had slid into the back room. You could hardly see the poker table, but everybody was peering at it and watching in silence. You know, watching a poker game isn't like watching most other card games, where all is silent while the hand is played, and then there's a round of relaxation and comment after the cards have been thrown into the pile. In this usual kind of card game, everybody sees all the cards by the time the cards are thrown in, so nobody's giving anything away by talking when the game's over. But in draw poker, half or more of the game is psychology, and you toss your hand face down into the pile, so no one can see what cards you held unless you're willing to stay in the game and bet that you're the winner. Hand after hand in poker is played with nothing showing at the end but a pair of whatever it took to open the betting. And nobody would be allowed to watch the game if he gave an indication of what the cards were that had been tossed face down into the pile. In draw poker, you pay for every card you see. As I stood at the door of the pool room, looking back at the poker table. A moment of my life came back to me, and I was a child watching a pageant of big boys dressed as sheep herders, trying to be statues bent over something mystic in a shining light. Turning to the barkeeper, nursing a shot of moonshine, I said, "It looks like Sunday school at Christmas." And I walked rapidly toward the back room, nervous that I was making any noise at all, and nervous also about that .38 I was leaving in my back. Although Mr. Smith was standing at the door of the poker room where he should be, he wasn't happy. According to the plan, he was to be the palace guard and keep out all except our guys. But when the earth had tilted, he obviously had been covered by a landslide. I told him, "The barkeeper has a .38. He didn't say a thing to me, but he shoved people aside until he got me to a spot right behind the cook. Before I really looked at the cook, I looked at the pile in front of him. It was a pile, all right. Not big, but $40 anyway. The other three at the table had big hat brims, but small piles of money. Bill Bell was standing right behind biggest brim. The light shade over the table almost cut Bill in half. In the semi-darkness above the light, his shoulders and hat were gigantic. Then suddenly beneath the light, his hands glared on his hips as if he had a gun. My attention stopped jumping while I studied him for a bulge around the waist or a shoulder strap, and I knew finally for sure it was going to be just a plain fight. As I was studying Bill, Biggest Brim moved his chair to the right, and when he moved a second time, I guessed that Biggest didn't like Bill directly behind him. Just as he took a look at Bill, Bill pushed a bystander to the right and got behind Biggest again. I thought if they go on doing this, he'll be in front of me before long. Just then the red-headed kid developed out of the shadows and became a form on one side of Biggest Brim. The red-headed kid was about my size, but he didn't budge an inch when Biggest tried to make another move to get another look at Bill. I didn't have to guess any longer about whether he would have shot on the fire line. Then who appeared on the other side of Biggest Brim but the gassed Canadian? He coughed, but he didn't move either. In front of me, the cook looked just as cocky as ever. In fact, standing over him, I could look down on that blue jay tuft sticking up from the back of his head. Being the only player not hidden by a hat, and being the only player with a fair-sized pile in front of him, he was the one we all watched most. He stood out even more when it was his turn to deal. And it was clear to me after a couple of rounds that the strategy of the faceless three, when it came to dealing cards, had changed completely since early evening, when they tried to draw me into the game by looking clumsy. Now every player knew the other was a gambling man. So the psychology had changed to shaking the other guy's confidence in his game. The three brims were pretty handy with cards, but no better than that. I was just beginning to find out that there were quite a few differences between my picture of a gambling man and a small-town shill who lies in wait for working stiffs with monthly checks. The cook, though, was a flash. The cards leaped out of the messy pile into his hands, and then darted out of his hands around the circle.